Going Linux, episode 108. Using the graphical user interface for shell command junkies, the advanced episode. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
And in today's episode, we continue our talk on how to do things point and click that the experts do at the command line. And this really isn't an advanced episode. This is the second half because we were running short of time last time.
Shh, don't tell people that.
Oh, yeah,
I think
right.
This is the advanced episode. Okay, we hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. Tom and I are pleased to provide the Going Linux podcast at no charge to you, our listeners. After all, we're a podcast about free and open source software. For quite some time, to help us defray the cost of hosting the website and producing the podcast, we've provided a donate button on our website. Now you have another alternative if you live in North America. We are proud to announce that we have been approached by a sponsor, and we've accepted them. For the first time ever, we can say, this episode is brought to you by Audible. Yes, we know there are many other podcasts sponsored by Audible, but we like to think that supporters of free and open source software would prefer to support a podcast about free and open source software. So if you listen to audiobooks, or if you're interested in finding out about audiobooks, Audible is the place to go. Actually, the place to go so that you're supporting our podcast when you go there is audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. When you go to that special Going Linux page and sign up for a free trial, you get a free audiobook download, and you're supporting our show. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 75,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and a 14-day trial today by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. That's www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux, audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. If you are outside of the United States or Canada, feel free to continue to support our podcast in the way you've always been doing by listening, and should you feel so inclined, go ahead and click that donate button. And thank you for supporting the Going Linux podcast. So we're continuing on from where we left off the last time, and just to review, this episode was inspired by an email from Jeff Kilpatrick, who is a Java programmer, an independent contractor, and he has been using Linux for a long time, primarily at the command line, and is trying to find graphical user interface ways to use Linux so that he can move over from Windows on the desktop. And we think we can help him out here.
A little bit.
Yeah. So we are going through a list of commands that he has provided us and discussing maybe a graphical alternative. So far, each of them, we have come up with at least one graphical alternative and discussing maybe some of the advantages of that. But more importantly, what is a graphical way of doing this and why would you even want to do that?
Sure.
So shall we dig into some of the commands where we left off, Tom?
I think we shall, Larry.
Okay.
And where are we going to start here, Larry?
Well, let's start with the rm command.
Okay.
This one, the RM, is the equivalent to delete or other commands. Well, if you were in Nautilus and you just hit the delete key on your keyboard, in most Linux systems, that's going to put it in the recycle bin. or the trash, depending on which distribution you're in. And recycle bin is kind of the Windows description for it.
Right.
You can also hold down the shift key and press the delete key once you've selected a file, and it'll delete it directly. And doing it that way is much more like the rm command does it. Bypass the trash completely. And if you're in Linux Mint, you'll notice that when you right-click on a file, both options are there on the context menu. You can put it in the trash, or you can delete it directly. And in most distributions within Nautilus, you can choose to have that option viewed there as well. So lots of different configuration to make that happen. And the way you do that, the option is, at least in Ubuntu, it's in the GNOME configuration editor. We're not getting into how to do configurations in this episode, but that's what you would use to go in and make that bypass the trash or delete it permanently.
Yeah, and I don't see a good reason to do that. If you've got enough drive space and everything else, why not leave yourself the option of going back later and fixing your oops?
Exactly. I have not put that option in my context menu in Nautilus, primarily because when I did have it available, I was deleting stuff all the time and going, oh, I shouldn't have deleted that. Right. Oh, I've really deleted that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's a much safer way to do it, and I can see why Ubuntu has decided not to enable that option by default.
But if you're doing your crossword puzzles in pen and ink, and you've got that much confidence that you're right, yeah, maybe you could.
Yeah.
And Jeff also asked in his email if there's a shell equivalent to RM that does the same thing, that deletes the file, but sends it to the trash instead of just deleting it right off the bat. And Larry, there is, right?
Exactly. And that command is called trash-cli. And you need to install that from the package manager or from the repositories because it isn't installed by default. But you can use that instead of the rm command, and it will move the file to the trash instead of bypassing the trash and deleting it directly.
There you go.
And the description in the repository says, this package provides a command line interface trash can utility compliant with the free desktop.org trash specification. It remembers the name, original path, deletion date, and permissions of each trashed file.
There you go.
So that sounds like exactly what you're looking for. So use the delete key on your keyboard, use the right click on the file and select from the context menu, and that is your graphical way of deleting a file.
Okay, and then he asks about FDisk. Oh, he says, I used to use FDisk, but now I use Gparted. That one may be too easy. Well, yeah, it's too easy. You're right. Gparted is the best. I stay away from FDisk in the command line because Gparted just does all the thinking for you and warns you when you're about to do something stupid.
Yeah, and that's the point of graphical user interface, isn't it? It walks you through it, and you have to do less thinking. And I think in our last episode, we mentioned that Jeff, one of his incentives for going to the graphical user interface is so that he doesn't have to remember all the different switches and options for each of the commands. The graphical user interface just knows what switches to use, what command options to use in executing what you ask it to do at the graphical user interface. And Jeff's next command is groupadd, G-R-O-U-P-A-D-D, and the various other commands that go along with that. And he details them as groupadd, useradd, changegroup, C-H-G-R-P, changeowner, C-H-O-W-N, chmod, and all those things. He said, I found system, admin, users, and groups, but wondered if there was something more powerful and interactive with respect to permissions. And when we're talking about adding users and groups, that is the best tool to use. At least it's provided as part of GNOME, and right. It's part of, it's in Ubuntu by default. permissions on files and changing owners on files. You can do that from within
Nautilus.
Within Nautilus, right. So how would one go about doing that, Tom?
Right-click on the file, and when the menu opens up, click on the Permissions tab, and there you go.
Right, and all your options are there. And if it's a file that's accessible only to root, you'll need to be root to do that. You can open Nautilus as an administrator with root permissions, and you can use the graphical way of changing the permissions. And since we're on that topic, how would one start Nautilus as a root user?
Well, now we're back to the command line.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one way to do it is to use Alt F2, and that brings up a graphical run command line. So we're using graphical interface here. All right.
Oh, yeah.
We're still running a command, but okay. So what you type in there is not sudo Nautilus, but rather gksu space Nautilus. And what that does is it runs Nautilus as a superuser. So GK for the GNOME interface and SU as superuser, and then Nautilus, of course. It asks you for your password, which I'm going to type in now. I'm doing this as we follow along.
Okay.
And now Nautilus opens up, and instead of your username dash file browser, it says root dash file browser. And now be very,
very careful.
If you delete a file here, it goes into the trash, but the only way you can empty that trash bin is from a root session of Nautilus.
And be careful anyway.
Yeah, be very, very careful.
Yeah. So, recapping, there's a couple ways to do this. One is to open a terminal and type sudo Nautilus. And the other is to hit Alt F2, and the Run Application GUI will come up, and you type gksu Nautilus.
Right. Okay. You want to tee up the next one, Tom?
You betcha. Next up, we've got MC, and that's something I don't use. That's, he says, good old Midnight Commander is the primary way I browse files. I did figure out that Nautilus has a split pane view with a move to other pane context menu, which I found Midnight Commander-ish and lovely, but as you know, Midnight Commander has much more functionality. I've seen a few supposed clones, but haven't tried them. Okay, well, I'm not a big Midnight Commander person. I'm happy with Nautilus, and especially now with tabbed browsing. So, Larry, any thoughts here?
Well, yeah, you can get a lot of plugins for Nautilus, and maybe we could identify where one would go to find those plugins. But there are some alternatives to Midnight Commander. And of course, you could use Midnight Commander at the command line, which is sort of kind of graphical. It's a text-based dual pane file manager. But you do need to use the keyboard to move things around as opposed to the mouse. So since neither of us use any of the available graphical alternatives, I found a good article on 10 alternatives to Midnight Commander for Linux. And I'll include a link in the show notes. It's an article from 2008, so it's not that old, and maybe most of these are still available. But Jeff, as you said in your email, with the ability to do split panes in Nautilus, and maybe with some additional plugins, you can achieve the same thing without having to install additional software.
Sure.
Our next command is a two-letter command, VI.
VI, there
which
you
is,
go.
Yes, VI. So VI or V, or there's an alternative to it called Vim, V-I-M. These are all text editors that are very advanced and have some specific things built in for programmers and will do many, many, many other things besides just simple text editing. So we could go down a very deep rabbit hole here, just talking about Vi, talking about Vim, talking about Emacs as an alternative to that. But those are all command line based text editors are very deep in terms of the subject area. But let's just kind of read what Jeff had said here. He said, not that it's relevant, but I don't think I'll ever give up my Vi. I like the GTK version. I've been using the GUI version on Windows for as long as I've been able to use it on Windows. I realize gedit is a nice editor, and occasionally I will use it for ad hoc search and replace. If I have the text AAA in multiple places and I need to replace AAA with a different text that I type for each instance, Vi has annoying extra strokes, C, W, then type your next, and then N for next. And in a notebook style, I can just type F3 or Control G, depending on the flavor, type the ad hoc text, F3, type new text, etc. Keystrokes are time.
True stuff. And once again, I'm kind of out on this one because I do use gedit and I love gedit, or as you say, gedit, and have really not used V or Vi.
Yeah, there's the gvim, which is the graphical version of Vi or Vim, which I think Jeff was mentioning when he was talking about using the GUI version. But he already knows about that.
Well, he said he knows about it in Windows.
Right, and it works the same in Linux, okay. But I think we should just dive into what comes on Ubuntu. Let's talk about the text editor.
Sure.
Gedit or Gedit or whatever you want to talk about. I know you can open multiple files in different tabs very easily from within Nautilus. How would you do that, Tom?
Well, to open multiple files, that's really easy in Nautilus. Just select them. And then right-click, and in the menu, hit Open With, and then select the gedit text editor.
And if you're sure that the files that you have selected are all text files and not shell scripts or something else that may not, by default, open up in a text editor, then what you could do, if you're sure they're all text files, select them in Nautilus and then just press the Enter key, and they'll all open up in multiple tabs in gedit.
Sure.
And there are some powerful search and replace features, like Jeff was saying in his email, in gedit that you can use the F3 key or whatever to cycle through. But the one thing that always bothered me when I started using gedit was there appeared to be no way to find special characters, like a new line or a new tab or carriage return, that sort of thing. And the way you do that is the backslash key. So if you type backslash N, that is a new line. If you select backslash T, that's the tab character. And the line feed or carriage return is backslash R. And if you're looking for a backslash character, you type backslash backslash.
Okay.
So it's not intuitively obvious from the graphical user interface, but if you go into the help for gedit, you'll find it there.
Okay.
Now, Jeff is a programmer, and he may be using some of the more advanced features of Vi for programming. And I'd like to throw out an option here that may just make gedit a little more attractive to Jeff. If you go to the View menu in gedit and you select Highlight Mode, there are a lot of options under Highlight Mode that allow you to use gedit to highlight the text as though it were C code or C++ code or Fortran code or Java code or the code you would use for a make file. That's all in the sources option. You can also highlight it as though it were script. So if you're doing DOS batch files. It'll even highlight the text file as though it were a DOS batch file or JavaScript or Perl or PHP or Python or Ruby. And if you're doing markup languages like HTML, it has that as a highlighting selection. Or if you're doing text for documentation, it will do DocBook. It will do LaTeX. It will do just text info, XML. And there are many, 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 many others in this. Many too many to go through.
Sure.
Did I say there were many?
Many.
Of them? Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of them. And what this does is it uses colors on the screen to highlight the difference between, let's say, a line of code or a variable or a text value, that sort of thing, depending on what language you're using or what particular type of text file it is.
Right. For instance, if you put a quote and then start typing what you want inside the quotes, all that stuff inside the quotes is going to be its own color until you add the end quote. So you can see right away if you've forgotten quotes because the colors will be messed up.
Right. So if all your text values for a variable you're programming for show up in the color green and it's trying to find the text values using those quotes, if you leave off that last quotation mark, it's not going to show up in green because it's going to think it's some other value there. So very handy if you're doing programming and coding or HTML code or whatever you're doing. Nice feature.
Very nice. And next up, Jeff talks about service. Okay, here's a command I didn't even know about. He says, I use the command line to start and stop services. You know, the typical sudo service tomcat 6 stop or sudo service dash dash status dash all to list them and or grep slash sed slash awk them. Yeah, Jeff, you're just outside my ballpark here, buddy. But in Windows, from NT to present, I use the service GUI that was very easy to use. There must be a Linux equivalent.
And I agree, there must be one, but this isn't something that I do on a regular basis, so I don't know what they would be. Maybe some of our more server administrator type folks that listen to this show could give us some alternatives, some graphical alternatives that would be a GUI way of starting and stopping services.
Well,
I know there's got to be one.
Larry, I think I got one.
Oh, good.
Let's see. I'm looking for it. How about system monitor?
Does system monitor start and stop?
It stops.
Service, yeah. Yeah, you can use system monitor to stop services.
Yeah, sure. You can go into system monitor, hit the processes tab, and we've got stop process, continue process, end process, kill process, change priority, memory maps, and open files. I don't know what open files or memory maps is about. But if you just want to stop a process for a while and then continue it later, you can do that. And if you
right.
want to kill it, you can kill it.
Yeah. Now, I was aware of that as part of the system monitor, but
right.
I think one of the key things as a system administrator you want to be able to do is start services from scratch again. And I'm not aware that you can do that at all within the system monitor unless there's an option that I'm not aware of there. And again, because this is something that I don't use on a regular basis, I've never really explored it.
But Jeff, you're a programmer. Make a GUI.
There you go. Exactly. Well, since we're on the topic of system monitor, it is the answer to Jeff's next question or command that he wants us to talk about, and that is top. Top is a command that you can use at the command line that is the equivalent of the system monitor. So looking at it from the other perspective, it's the command line alternative to the system monitor's graphical user interface. And the PS space AX command or the PS space AUX command, those are some of the equivalents, Tom, you were just talking about. What Jeff wrote about this is, I still use top even though I also use the System Resources app, which I'm assuming he means is the system monitor. I know it's silly, but I hate having to click the tabs to see different parts of resource monitoring. Is there a GUI version with a single pane resource, like the top, that ideally uses keyboard commands, like the comma in top or F/choices keystrokes to change the view and sort? Maybe additional keystrokes to switch between text and graphical representations. I do like the pretty graphics in the system monitor. Having instant access to kill and other commands is very nice in system monitor. I wrote a little utility, there you go, he's already doing this, that allows me to search for any term in any PSAX. It seems System Monitor only lets me type a search using standard GNOME window search, which matches the first word only and then only of the primary process name. So, Jeff, I think, you know, you could try some key bindings to try to get the keystrokes to be what you want them to be. But there are plenty of keystroke commands in System Monitor that let you do some things. I searched through the help there to see what's available. But it sounds like you want a graphical user interface method that uses all the key commands that you use on the command line. Probably sticking with top is the best way to go.
Sure. Okay, Jeff, and then another alternative for you to top is also a terminal command, but it's pretty cool. There's a package called htop. And reading the description from the Synaptic Package Manager, it says HTOP is an ncurst-based process viewer similar to TOP, but it allows you to scroll the list vertically and horizontally to see all processes and their full command lines. Tasks related to processes, like killing and renicing, can be done without entering their PIDs. And as an aside, it's pretty. It's colorful.
Yes, it is. Lots of nice, pretty colors. I just stick to System Monitor for what I want to do, but I'm sure not doing the same sorts of things that Jeff is doing. So hopefully we've given you some ideas there, and maybe our listeners can make some suggestions as well.
Yeah, Jeff's over in the deep end of the pool.
Yep, exactly.
And then Jeff also writes, new subject, generic programming stuff. He says, it's already a joy to be able to use real IDEs like Eclipse and or NetBeans for Java programming. No more Vim plus Ant for building. Nice. But that won't really help many of your users.
Well, Jeff, most of our users are not programmers.
Right.
So you're absolutely right in that last comment. But I like Eclipse as well. I have used it a little bit at work for some of the work that I do. Another graphical user interface for Python. There are actually many graphical user interfaces for Python. And we'll have a link in the show notes to some of those and another link with additional details on many of the various versions of graphical user interface for those of our listeners who are using Python as their programming language of choice. And for those of our listeners who have been working in the Microsoft world and are a bit of Visual Basic experts, if you really want to apply a lot of that knowledge that you have without having to take the time to learn Python or some of the more cross-platform programming languages, there is a program that allows you to use many of your Visual Basic skills, and it's called Real Basic. It's cross-platform as well. It works in Linux and Mac and Windows, and you can write programs for any of those platforms using this tool. It is a proprietary tool, however, but it is very similar, very reminiscent of Visual Basic 6. So not so much the .NET development now, but if you were a Visual Basic 6 expert, almost all of your knowledge would be immediately transferable. And even if you've been using .NET and the more recent versions, much of what you already know will allow you to be immediately in a familiar environment when you're using Real Basic. So you might want to try that out, but I would really encourage you to learn Python or PHP or right. something that's a lot more cross-platform, especially if you're going to be developing for Linux.
Very similar to Real Basic is Gambas, G-A-M-B-A-S, and I believe that is open source, but the documentation is just terrible on it.
Yeah, I've tried using Gambas as well, and I agree.
Yeah, but Larry's right. If you can bypass Basic altogether, because I started with Basic, and it just hobbled me. It's not a good place to start. It teaches you bad habits.
I would agree with that, having learned a lot of those bad habits up front.
Sure, you got.
All right. I think, Tom, the whole SSH and Samba clients and that sort of stuff, that's a whole topic unto its own. So
Jeff asked several questions about SSH and SMB client and that kind of thing. I don't think we're going to go there today.
No, I think maybe we can take that and make it an episode all on its own. And we certainly have plans to do at least one episode on remote control. And right. we might actually get into some of that when we do that. I also think we might talk about FTP clients and moving files between clients and servers
sure.
and that sort of stuff. And that would fit perfectly in that sort of area. So let's just defer those questions to a future episode.
Okay.
And move on to MySQL.
Oh, that's how you say it. I've only read it and I just say MySQL.
Well, many people say it MySQL. Okay. And some call it MySQL. And I think if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong here, I think SQL is kind of the equivalent of a brand name, if you will,
okay.
and SQL is more generic. I could be wrong.
But it's spelled MySQL, and mm-hmm. that is the database that is a basis of many Linux servers.
Right, and you can write queries on a MySQL database or a SQL database of any sort, MySQL being kind of the open source version
right.
of SQL, which is a proprietary database. And those queries can be very powerful to allow you to find things, and you can use lots of commands to update things in the database from the command line. And Jeff says he has enjoyed having the GUI admin and less so, but still nice query tools available. PHP MyAdmin never really did much for me, but the GUI tools installed with MySQL-query-browse and MySQL-admin are very good. And Jeff, those are very good graphical tools for working with MySQL. Eclipse has some tools for this built into its IDE as well. And I think between all of those, we don't have any better recommendation.
No.
All right, our next one is wget. This one I know you use, Tom.
Yep.
And Jeff asks, is there an FTP/downloading GUI and downloads manager? I'm guessing it's just easier to use wget.
Well, that all depends, Jeff. wget is pretty fast and easy. And Larry's found a pretty nice page that's a comparison of FTP client software. And we'll put that link in the show notes.
Yeah, there are lots of options.
Right. And there's FileZilla. Tell us about FileZilla, Larry.
Well, FileZilla is the one that I use, and it is cross-platform, which is one of the reasons why I use it. I like to try to use cross-platform software
sure.
wherever I can. And for those of you moving over from Windows, of course, it's available as well. There's a server version. There's a client version. And specifically what this does is it allows you to take files and move them using FTP transfer protocols. So you can put files on your web server or bring files down from the web server. Of course, you have to have administrator access to that server or at least an FTP account on the server. But the FileZilla program allows you to use many different types of FTP. And in fact, Fraser, one of our listeners we've communicated with in the past, was asking me some questions recently about FTP. And FTP is a protocol that like I said, allows you to move files back and forth, but everything is sent in the open. There is absolutely no security on it. And one of the nice things about FileZilla and many of the graphical alternatives that we've provided, they will use SFTP or FTPS, two different ways of making that file transfer secure. FTPS uses SSL, which we just said we're going to skip over
for now,
and SFTP uses an alternative that allows you to secure it using some additional STL type security. So there are ways for you to secure FTP transfers, and FileZilla supports, if not all, then certainly most of them. I really like it.
If you were going to use wget, you're looking at a web page. What you're probably going to do is find something that you want to download. Let's say, a Going Linux podcast.
Good choice.
Audio file, yeah. What you would normally do if you want to use wget is right-click, copy the location, open your terminal, type wget and whatever other options you want in there, and then paste the address into wget. Okay, that's one way to do it. Here's another way. Open Nautilus first, then go to our web page, and click and drag that MP3 file or that OGG file down to where Nautilus is minimized in your dock. Wait for Nautilus to open, drag the file up into that open window and let go, and it'll download. Okay, that was one click.
Yes, and that uses wget, does it?
I don't know. I don't know. It's
all right.
It's Nautilus magic. I don't know if it will try to resume a failed fetch or any of that stuff. I just know it works.
Yeah, that's great. That is definitely a one-click graphical user interface way of getting a file. And the nice thing about wget, as you just alluded to there, Tom, is that if your connection gets interrupted or your network connection gets very slow, wget will pause and it will resume very nicely. And that's really one of the advantages of wget beyond all types of file transfers, is that it really does a good job of it, and it is extremely fast. I've been amazed. All of the other graphical ways of doing it for me have been very slow, and if I need something fast, I just use wget.
Right. And also with Nautilus, it will download, I believe, up to 6 files at a time. So you click, drag, drop, click, drag, drop, and they'll all
kind of queues them up.
Download at the same time. Well, it doesn't queue them up one after the other. It's doing them all at once.
Yeah, simultaneously. Yeah.
Right.
Nice. Very good. I'm going to have to try that. I was unaware of that. Thanks, Tom. And now Jeff mentions DPKG. And we have talked about installing files, repositories, the Synaptic Package Manager. DPKG is, in the background, the command that all these things are using.
Right.
And at the command line, you would type sudo space dpkg dash dash install, and then you could list files one after the other to install them. And some of the graphical alternatives there are to use the Synaptic Package Manager, which, of course, in addition to doing the installation, actually also helps you search through the repositories to find what you want, which you could do using the command line. And there are ways to do that on the command line, of course, but the Synaptic Package Manager really makes that easy. And if you have the file downloaded already, of course, you can use the simple double-click on the file, and it will open using the GDebi program, which installs the package for you using DPKG in the background. Of course, the really, really simple way to install packages is to use the Software Center. And that uses all the same stuff in the background, but it's got a nice graphical candy store, sure, storefront sort of interface that is very nice for the less sophisticated user who is probably not even listening to this episode because it's way beyond them.
Now, is a Software Center, has that replaced the Synaptic Package Manager?
Oh, absolutely not. Okay. And what we're talking about here for non-Ubuntu users, the Software Center is available in the Applications menu, and it's the very bottom entry. It's Ubuntu Software Center, and it's just a user interface that shows you software applications that are in the repositories. It's not going to show you everything, and I don't think you can even search for everything in the Software Center, but it's going to allow you to look at them in their various categories and find out which ones are the most popular and that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's more of a storefront interface sort of thing.
But everything's free.
Well, everything right now is free. I think their intention is to offer software for sale there as well,
okay,
when there are some for sale packages available for Linux. And the Synaptic Package Manager, though, is still there. It's still in the System Administration Synaptic Package Manager menu entry.
Okay.
And you can still use that, whichever one you like. Or, of course, you can use the command line. You can use apt-get or dpkg,
right,
to do your installation. And
so Software Center has replaced add-remove.
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And that is an Ubuntu specific thing. Okay, so the Software Center. In Linux Mint, it's called something else. In other Debian distributions, it's probably still called add-remove. And in Red Hat-based applications, who knows what?
Yeah, who knows?
And Tom, I think that's pretty much it for covering all the commands. Thanks, Jeff,
for your
suggestion.
Thanks for the exercise. A lot of the things I told you were actually more than I knew. So
now, how does that work,
Tom? I don't know.
That's the advantage of researching things, I guess, and learning. We're learning as we go along.
We sure
here
are.
As well. Yeah, you bet. Yeah, so thanks. And thanks, Jeff, for giving us two episodes worth of content as well.
There you are.
Now, Tom, I don't know about you, but I have a software pick.
You know, I don't think I have one, but go ahead.
My software pick is Peppermint One. Have I talked about this before? I think I have.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? Well, this is a Linux distribution based on Linux Mint, which of course is based on Ubuntu, which of course is based on Debian. So this is a derivative of a derivative of a derivative, but it is nice. And for a netbook or a low-powered computer, this distribution is absolutely phenomenal. It uses the XFCE window manager and desktop environment, and it augments that with a lot of things from LXDE and from GNOME to make this a very functional user interface and desktop environment.
Okay, so it's real fast and...
It is extremely fast, primarily because it doesn't install most packages as well. It is designed so that when you go to, let's say, Office, you don't get OpenOffice. You get links to Google Docs.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And so there's a Google Docs entry in the Office menu. There's a Google Mail entry. There's a Google Reader. There's an ePDF viewer. And there's a Google Calendar entry. So it's relying heavily on cloud-based applications, Google in particular. And the thing that it's using to make those show up in their own window as opposed to showing up in your standard web browser. They actually, when you launch them, they look like an application and it's running Google Docs or it's running Gmail inside something that makes it look like its own little application.
No kidding.
Yeah, the program it's using is called Prism. And in the Peppermint menus, you'll find it under the Internet menu selection. And Prism is really cool. It is When you open it, it's a nice user interface that has some very simple selections and buttons. It allows you to create a launcher in your menu and or on your desktop that allows you to open a web page as though it were an application. The first space you type something in is the URL for the website. Then you give it a name that appears in the menu, and you can choose to show the navigation bar if you wish, to show the status messages, and to show the navigation keys. And these are all the user interface of Prism, which is kind of its own little web browser, if you will.
Okay.
And then it says, where do you want it to appear in the menu system? And then select an icon that appears next to the menu item. And it also has a little button there. If you don't have your own icon you want to use, you can try downloading it from the website. And then just click apply and you've created your own launcher. So what they've done is they have, for many of the applications, provided application launchers that open up in Prism and make the website look like its own little application. So it's not just the Office applications, but if you look at the internet menu selection, it has a link to Facebook, it has a link to the Peppermint Forum, of course, the Seismic Web, and it's got some applications installed like XChat for IRC and Transmission. But if I go to the sound and video menu selection, it's got Cheese, of course, for your webcam, should you have one. It's got Xaile, E-X-A-I-L-E, which is a media player. It has a link to Hulu. It has a link to Last.fm, to Pandora, to a cloud media player. And it's got XF Burn, which is the CD burner software that works in XFCE. And it's got a link right there to YouTube as well, all launching as though they were their own little application and using the Prism application to frame it so that it looks like its own little application.
That is neat. And I'm looking at the Synaptic Package Manager's description, and it says, Prism, previously called WebRunner, is a simple XUL runner-based browser that hosts web applications without the normal web browser user interface. It's based on a concept called site-specific browsers, SSB. XUL Runner is a single Gecko runtime that can be used to bootstrap multiple XUL and XPCOM applications that are as rich as Firefox and Thunderbird.
Yes, and I've been playing around a little bit with this, and it is just everything it said. It's really nice little web browser that is specifically geared to launching applications. It's excellent. So I would encourage folks to try out the Peppermint OS, Peppermint One OS. We'll have a link in the show notes to the website on where you can download it. And this is their first official release of Peppermint. That's, I'm assuming, why they call it Peppermint One. And I really like it for an underpowered computer, really old computer. This would be a way of bringing it up to current standards. And of course, since it's based on Linux Mint, it has all the codecs installed for media playing, and it is it has all of the other applications that you would normally have installed available in the package manager. So if you want something installed on your computer, you can have it. But if you don't, you don't have to take up the disk space. And in older computers, typically disk space is at a premium as well. So very lightweight, very fast. And one of the nice things that I've found about Peppermint, as opposed to some of the other XFCE-based distributions out there, is that they have supplemented some of the things that XFCE doesn't have by default with those tools and features from other window managers and desktop environments. So it will be very, very easy to use for even a novice Linux user right out of the box without having to use the command line to do some configuration and things that you would normally have to do if all you were using were XFCE. Very nicely put together. Lots of very good fit and finish on this. And I like it a lot. I've got it installed on an old notebook computer that has such low specs that about the only thing that would run on it right now is Linux Mint.
Okay.
So Peppermint runs even faster. Nice.
All right, my software pick, which I've just installed now and I really haven't played with yet, is something called Prism.
Very good.
And I'll let you know later how I like that. But I've installed that on a regular Ubuntu machine, and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. It's the first time I'd actually played around with Prism for real. I had heard about it on another podcast and kind of dismissed it as, maybe I'll try that out someday. But having seen what they have done with it in Peppermint, I think I might actually just install that on my main Ubuntu machine.
Yeah, I just did.
Has some key launchers there. Let us know how that goes, Tom.
Okay. So what are we doing in our next episode, Larry?
Haven't got a clue.
Okay.
We are recording this so much in advance because I'm going on some vacation, and we wanted to ensure that we had an episode ready to go when I get back from vacation. So we'll fill you in on the next episode.
Okay.
Until then, you can go to our articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, illustrations, and more.
You can email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site. And you'll find that Podcast Alley button right on the left side of any of our pages.
Yeah, and for a while, in the month of July, mm-hmm. we were number one in the tech category. That lasted for about the 1st and the 2nd of July. But hey, we were number one. So you can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word. You can download the episodes from the website, or you can use the Flash Player to play them right on the show notes page.
You can get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as new episodes are available. How do you do that, you ask? Well, you follow the instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast on our website. You'll find that at subscribe.goinglinux.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.